everybody. J.J. Cooper, John Manuel. Okay, well, I often will say a special edition of the Baseball America podcast, but this is truly a special edition. For those newbies, this may be like, okay, but for you old heads, for you who have been there since the beginning, because we began doing podcasts at Baseball America in 2007, I believe. So we're
October 2006, JJ.
Yes, six. So, and we were both there for the first one. I wasn't allowed to touch the mic for a while, but I was there. I was the producer. That was my first podcasting job. But, and then if you remember, basically we started doing playoff podcasts because we both would be the first two in the office in the morning. And then we'd get in the office and we would talk about the playoffs. And eventually we're like, why don't we just record this? So we are bringing that back together. We have a special World Series preview. And we're going to talk all about what we see happening, what we think is going to happen for the World Series. We're going to talk about the Dodgers. We're going to talk about the Blue Jays. We're going to talk about not probably as much how the Dodgers can win. I think that's, you know, okay. I'll summarize that right now. How the Dodgers can win. Keep pitching like they've been pitching. Have enough home runs. Done. Moving up. But we're going to talk about the Blue Jays in detail on that. But we're going to talk a lot about that. But John, great to see you. What, like, for the postseason so far for you, what has stood out before we get to the World Series?
I would say, the first of all, the game quality. We've had a lot of tight games. They haven't all been cleanest games, but there have been a lot of very competitive games. The American League, I think we knew, even coming into the year, that the American League was kind of wide open. It played out that way, especially once the Tigers kind of hit a speed bump and weren't the same team that kind of opened up the American League. But I think that the game seven, that was a thriller. That was an all-time, we're going to remember that game for a while, I think. And I guess the other thing that has stood out is, you know, it's unavoidable, I think, to talk about. We do have two teams that are top five in payroll. Obviously, the Dodgers are 1-2 pretty much every year. You know, for a while it was Dodgers and Yankees, and now it's Dodgers and Mets just about every year. But Toronto spends. So I think Jeff Ponce put it in one of y'all's recent podcasts, like, Toronto is being rewarded for trying. And that's a good thing. I mean, no shade to the Arizona-Texas World Series of 2023. That was fun. And I think it's also good to know that there's randomness. And that means that teams that don't spend at this level can win. Of course, Texas spends a lot.
So that was a Corey Seager-led, Marcus Semien-led team.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say, it's like, what is it, $475 million middle infield. So it's not like they don't spend. And then they went out and spent on DeGrom the next year. But these are two top five payrolls. I think it's impossible to ignore. But what that does is it buys you some cushion, and also that starting pitching is expensive. And you mentioned the Dodgers, and you know, you and I are of a certain age and of a certain geography in the American Southeast. So we both watched a lot of Braves games growing up, and we knew the difference between a Rick Camp-led rotation and a Greg Maddux-led rotation. You know, we figured out the difference. Well, wow, it looks a little different with Avery and Smoltz at the front and that kind of power that the Braves had when they started their run. But this Dodgers rotation is an epic rotation, and that costs money, but it also takes really good scouting and development, JJ. And I think we need to give the Dodgers both the credit for the evaluation and also the credit for developing it and getting these guys, being able to not cruise, but not floor it during the regular season, still win 93 games, which is hard to do, and have all these starters essentially peaking for the postseason. That's just from a evaluation standpoint of what we've been doing, you know, the last 8 years for me for the Twins and 21 before that with BA. It's impressive just to see what kind of stuff the Dodgers are running out there night in, night out on the bump.
That kind of leads to our first topic here, which is, like, we could talk about, yes, I mean, it is not exactly a insightful deep analysis to say this Dodgers rotation is really good, but to take it a step further, it does strike me as that this is a perfectly built rotation for the playoffs. Now, not for the regular season. If you're saying you're a team that is trying to, you know, that that is projected to win 87 games, and you could win 90 or you could win 84. Having a rotation front, you know, that includes Blake Snell, Tyler Glasnow, and Shohei Ohtani coming off of TJ would not be what you want, because we are talking about that Yoshinobu Yamamoto is the only pitcher of these four in the postseason rotation who threw 100 innings this year. Like, this is not – Blake Snell has qualified for the ERA title twice in his 10-year career. Won Cy Young Awards both times, but twice. Tyler Glasnow is still waiting for that first time that he qualifies for an ERA title. But if you said, who do you want in the postseason, durability becomes much less of a factor, I would say, over the course of a month than pure bat missing stuff. And if you said, who are the best pitchers in baseball, best starters in baseball for dominance, pure bat missing stuff, Blake Snell, Tyler Glasnow, and Shohei Ohtani all are near the very top of the list on that. Is this kind of a perfect playoff rotation in a lot of ways?
Yeah, you didn't even mention the highest paid, the largest free agent contract for in history for a pitcher, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Right. I mean, it's amazing. And you and I, when he was coming over, you were so excited about him. I just remember watching his delivery and saying, man, that is extremely efficient. It really, his delivery reminded me of Tim Lincecum, what with his size and then just the efficiency and the kind of the torque he produces in his body.
Because he is little.
He's small. And then, you know, again, Rob Friedman, Pitching Ninja, does a great job with this. I mean, but kudos to him. He's kind of shown with the overlay, the evolution of that delivery. It's just, there's no wasted movement. And so you have these, you know, Snell, whose biggest, besides not qualifying for the ERA title, his inefficiency, like when he threw the no-hitter for the Giants and it was his first career complete game and he, you know, kind of gave it to people afterwards, criticized him. Aside from that no-hitter, I mean, his most famous moment, and maybe still with the no-hitter, his most famous moment is, all right, I pitched five innings plus or six innings plus in the World Series, and they took me out third time through with the Rays in 2020. I mean, the most famous moment of his career came against the Dodgers, and for what he couldn't do, which was be trusted, even with his best stuff, to go a third time through the order. We're not going to debate that five years out.
5.1 innings, 18 batters faced.
That's what it was. It was very much by the numbers. And I don't hear, you know, it was 2020. Everything was off that year. Everything. We all know that. But yeah, to back to the Dodgers, it is kind of a perfect rotation for the postseason because of the power. You might quibble, hey, they could use a left-hander. I mean, I guess you could say that a perfect rotation for the postseason is Koufax three times in 7 days or whatever it did. And, you know, game seven was on 2 days rest in 1965. Maybe that's perfect rotation, right?
So or you could argue, I brought this up on another pod this week, that like you could also say the 63 Dodgers where Koufax goes twice, Drysdale goes twice. Once, and Johnny Padres goes once. And Johnny Padres is he's the weak link because he went 8 1/3 in his outing. Which did mean that Ron Paranowski got to throw two-thirds of an inning, which is the entire contribution of the bullpen, because they held the Yankees with Mantle, Maris, Berra, all them, to 4 runs in 4 games. And Koufax got 2 complete games. Drysdale got 1. And again, like I said, Johnny Padres only threw 8 1/3. Yes.
Great job by them, Mikey. Great job by them. I mean, we got to give it up. We saw those guys at Brooklyn. We saw it coming. Anyway, sorry. It was an imperfect rotation for the regular season. This is where I was trying to go before I sidetracked myself with a stupid.
It's not a John and JJ pod if there's not some tangents.
I mean, I am Captain Tangent. But during the regular season, Yamamoto is the only one of those guys who qualified for the ERA title. I mean, they had 22 starts by, you know, Clayton Kershaw, 2006 high school draft. You know, I wrote a lot about Clayton Kershaw in my old gig. Dustin May was 18 starts. You know, they started Landon Knack during the regular season. You know, last year they were the imperfect rotation. It was still a high ceiling rotation. It was still 2 first-round picks in Walker Buehler and Jack Flaherty and Yamamoto, but the rest of it was bailing wire and guys who, you know, were long relievers basically. Ben Kasparius and our main man Brent Honeywell. And this is where I was going, JJ. You really This is kind of my theory, and it's bouncing off a story you wrote at baseballamerica.com earlier in the week about the kind of the demise of the 4-5 starter. And I guess where I kind of take that turn is both these teams, I think, are an example, and what the money really is for, as Don Draper said, is the money, in my mind, is for building two rotations. You have to have a regular season rotation, and you have to have a postseason rotation. And these two teams really exemplify it. I don't know if it's a trend. If it is a trend, it's bad for the rest of the teams who can't afford to do this. But the Dodgers had their regular season rotation, which was, let's get through, you know, 162 games, better than the Padres, which was a challenge, you know, because the Padres are really going for it. But then you have to have a fresh slate of starters for the postseason. And Toronto, I guess, the surprising part, JJ, is that they've been able to pull this off with really a postseason rotation that is quite different from the regular season one.
I would interject here that they've done kind of the same thing here in that, like you say, the Dodgers, the stat I've used with the Dodgers is this Dodgers postseason rotation, these starters threw less than 50% of their starter pitcher innings in the regular season, and now they're close to 80% of all of their innings in the postseason. But then when you talk about the Blue Jays, the starters that got them here were Kevin Gausman. Okay, right. That one is still in the rotation. Chris Bassitt, Jose Berrios, Eric Lauer, Max Scherzer, and Bowden Francis. That's their guys who had 10-plus starts for them in the regular season. And I know Berrios is hurt, you know, but let's be honest, if he wasn't hurt, I don't know if he'd be in the rotation right now. And
Bassett's not in the rotation. We last seen pitching a good inning in the eighth inning of game 7, but still, like, he threw what, 2 2/3 innings all the way here.
I think he was not on the LDS roster. He was on the LCS. He made 2 appearances for 2 2/3 innings. That one inning that will be very much remembered in game 7, like, that was then he cruised through it, located, landed some curveballs, you know, like, surprised some guys, all that. But as you said, that rotation got them here. And then they're like, okay, Gausman's rounding into premium form. And then you have Max Scherzer, who did make a start in the LCS, but it's kind of like, okay, I think it was smart of them. Left him off the LDS roster, let him kind of marinate, let him kind of let that adrenaline build to kind of get maximum Max Scherzer, and boom, that's what we got. So it is something like where they have a whole different rotation too.
Let's take you through the Arena Club Slab Pack experience. This is part two because Todd Father last week pulled a card that he didn't love, yet he sold it back for actually more than what the Slab Pack cost. This time, pulls a card that he likes.
Yeah, and this is the best part of it. Ronnie Mauricio, the Mets standout, you know, rookie sensation. He's been absolutely phenomenal. I like the itch of seeing what you're going to get. You know, I like prospects. I don't love them. But seeing this kind of card is actually absolutely beautiful thing. I know a couple people around town that would absolutely love that card. So there's going to be a lot of conversations going on here for Arena Club.
And what you do is you have it in your digital showroom. If you want to hand it out locally, then cool. You ask Arena Club to send it to you, and they do. Or you can sell it back, like you see there. Instant offer for $193, but he's keeping it. And you can do what Todd Father does by going to arenaclub.com/foul and getting 20% off your first card purchase or your first slab pack purchase.
Yeah, can we get Max Scherzer on 20 days rest again if you're Toronto? And the answer, signs point to no, but I mean, it certainly worked and they got the best version of him. I think the funny part for them and the two rotations part is Eric Lauer. You know, Eric Lauer was, I believe, a minor league free agent signing for them in the offseason. Mm-hmm. Had to earn his spot in spring training. Kudos to him, number one, for earning it. Second of all, for coming back, and he was our best starting pitcher for a large swath of the regular season. He had a 3.18 ERA during the regular season, but he hasn't been anywhere near important innings in the postseason for Toronto. So that's really where we are, I think, and I think we saw it also writ large with Seattle. I thought there was some fatigue with the Mariners' rotation in the postseason. I think that was supposed to be their strength as you evaluate them as an organization the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, clearly an ill-timed injury to Brian Wu. You know, I think if you're Mariners fans, your biggest what-if from the ALCS is the way they use their bullpen in Game 7. The number two what-if is Brian Wu. What if he just stays healthy? What if you know, the novelty of how awesome it was that he went, what, 23, 24 starts in a row with six innings and no more than one walk, two walks, whatever that stretch was. It was a Cy, it was a Denton true Cy Young, you know, stretch of command and durability. And maybe you sacrifice that to have him healthier in October. I mean, I don't know if that would have happened or not, but that's a what if.
So this is the kind of the embodiment of, I would say, the traditional rotation of what you're looking for. They have five starters who are exceptional. They're all there. They're all really good. And here we are where you would say that that's what you want. But Logan Gilbert was two in, was a 7.71 ERA in the LCS. George Kirby was a 10.13 ERA in the LCS. Now, Bryce Miller was played 1.80 ERA. But Luis Castillo, 11.57 ERA. You had one of the best rotations built. And three of the four starters who started for them had ERAs above seven in the LCS. As you said, it didn't feel like that they were all at their best. Maybe that's because they've actually gone through the entirety of a season.
So I think what we've seen is kind of the efficacy of a Chris Bassitt or an Eric Lauer or that kind of pitcher is someone who can be good enough to get you through the regular season. And the, you know, and those innings are important. Those regular season innings are important. If the Blue Jays had lost one more game, they're the four seed, not the one seed. They're behind the Yankees. I mean, in the regular season, they were just better than the Yankees. But the biggest way they were better than the Yankees was playing at Rogers Center. They dominated New York in the regular season in Toronto and in the postseason in Toronto, where they kind of clubbed them in those two games in the division series. But did they get to the World Series if they aren't the one seed? They had the same record as the Yankees in the regular season. And then they were, you know, much better in extra inning games than they were, than the Yankees were. That was really the difference in the regular season. Kind of hat tip to Joe Sheehan, who pointed that out pretty regularly in his newsletter all year, that a lot of the second and third order parts of evaluating these teams favored the Yankees. But so that one, just one or two games really were crucial. Every single regular season game was crucial, really, for Toronto at the end of the season, because they tied for first place in the AL East with the Yankees. And they, but by virtue of winning that tie, that tiebreaker, they had home field advantage and they, you know, took advantage of it. So they had to have those back of the rotation guys pitch really well for them. And, you know, Jose Berríos, you know, that's a challenging one. He's locked up for several more years still. And, you know, he's young-ish. He's 31 years old. But that guy's whole calling card has been durability. So I think there has been a recognition by the Blue Jays front office that they have valued durability maybe more than some other front offices have. But at the same time, I think the other part of this, the other X factor for them was Yesavage. Getting Trey Yesavage to be this end-of-the-season kind of ace or good enough to be a five or six inning starter. Maybe that's the part that they didn't necessarily plan on having, but he's been the difference maker that's really allowed them to have a second rotation, basically.
I do think they kind of did plan on it too, though, to their credit, which is, I think it was always structured this year to get him to October and healthy and okay.
But, and he's done it to their credit and to his. They've nurtured him through the whole season, and he has been able to make it work and get outs in Dunedin and get outs in Vancouver and at every step along the way. I mean, he didn't qualify for the ERA title anywhere either, JJ, but that's just because he kept on moving through different levels. So, you know, I got to see him last year in Lynchburg, Virginia, pitching for East Carolina against Liberty. And his former high school teammate was his opponent that night for Liberty. And it was a fun game, and it was fun to scout and to see, like, this is a guy you just haven't seen. And then you're looking at the data afterwards, and you're like, this is data I haven't seen, because the release point is so high. It is so different. And I can see why major league hitters are having a hard time adjusting to it as well. And this will be the first look at him for the Dodgers, right? And I don't think there's a lot of overlap between these two teams' farm systems either. I don't think there's any overlap.
None.
So, you know, Traject can only do so much. And this is a different dude. So the Dodgers have a lot of information on Kevin Gausman. That doesn't make him easy to prepare for. There are not very many pitchers who are fastball split 90% of the time. So, and I will just throw in for the old heads, I love California. I mean, California. I love Colorado high school products. And Kevin Gausman is a Colorado high school pitcher. And he is the best current version of that genre. And I just love those dudes. So Gausman is, I think, the underrated guy here. I don't think we think of him as a true number one starter. I don't know where Andy McCullough puts him in his aces ranking. To me, Kevin Gausman is pretty close to a true number one. You know what's coming, and he's still hard to hit. And when he's on his game, he could dominate. And so I think the other key to this two rotations idea is you do have to have a true number one at the front of this rotation. And for the Dodgers, that has been Yamamoto. Mm-hmm. And again, that's what the money is for. $325 million. He had a bumpy rookie season, but he was good enough in October last year when the Dodgers needed him to be one of those three main starters. And this year he has, for an encore, he has been outstanding, has been everything they expected. And for the Blue Jays, it's been Gausman. And guess what? They paid a lot of money for Kevin Gausman too. So I think to make this two rotations work, you do have to have, it helps to have some power, fire-breathing dragons, as they say, available for the postseason. It helps to have some load-bearing kind of back of the rotation stalwarts like a Bassett or a Barrios. So those guys can be expensive too. But I think you have to have that number one guy to who can give you both, who can give you innings and production in the regular season and innings and power and production in the postseason. So it's just something that seems like it's happening more often as we go through like the this era of just chewing up and spinning out pitching staffs in the postseason. It's just the pitchers are giving so much effort. The stuff is so high quality. I think you have done as good a job, if not better than anybody in the media, of detailing the value of velocity and the need for it for championship teams. And these two teams have some of that, but I guess the Dodgers really do have more. And that's, if I look at these two pitching staffs, they have some similarities in their structure, but the Dodgers, they've got the gas. And it doesn't mean that Toronto doesn't, but LA has more. That's a big advantage, I think, for the Dodgers.
The Dodgers have four guys who, if they're on a night, just there's not much you can do. I mean, that's just the reality of it. They have four starters who, every single one of them, if they're on, you end up with quotes at the end of the night where someone says, you know, well, you got to just tip your cap to them. You know, if you execute your pitches like that, it's going to be really a difficult night. Like, that's just the kind of the cliche that comes out of it, because all these guys are that good. But there's one other kind of very fascinating conundrum for this postseason, for this World Series, I'm sorry, which is Bo Bichette looks like he's ready to rejoin the roster. Okay. But the Blue Jays have used a better defense in the postseason. I would say that we could clearly say that Jimenez has played, generally been in deference to Bichette during the season when they were both healthy. But now that Andrés Giménez is their shortstop, he's just a better shortstop defensively, especially than a somewhat limited and injured Bo Bichette. Bo Bichette's back now. You want his bat in the lineup, but how do you think you best kind of figure out a way to do this?
Getting the right people in the door quick is critical to maintain your company's workflow. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it puts the best and most qualified candidates in front of you quickly. Plus, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica. Just go to Indeed.com/BaseballAmerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. The holidays can sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has a host of unique, high-quality, and often handmade gifts, many of which are crafted by independent artists and small businesses. That attention to detail often means products are made in small batches, so the best finds can sell out fast, like the book of famous Dodgers newspaper clippings ordered on Uncommon Goods that I received as a birthday gift. It was a special present catered to my liking that can't be found anywhere else. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard baseball fans like me, to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not only finding the best and most unique gifts for the people you care about, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice and have donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/BA2022. That's uncommongoods.com/BA2022 for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Well, first of all, I just want to let you know that Patton Oswalt in Parks and Rec is just playing on a loop in my head, talking about Boba Fett coming back. And so I can't get that out of my head. So this, putting that off to the side. For me, Boba Fett is not, he's an impending free agent. That's part of this story. If I'm Boba Fett, I'm volunteering. Let me play second base. I want to reassure teams that I can play second base. If they're going to pay, if they're going to give me a nine-figure contract, I want them to feel confident that they can do that with me at second base. I know there's some risk attached there if you're Boba Fett, but to me, second base, which he's never played in the major leagues, and I'm going to guess he never played in the minor leagues, and I'd have to ask Nick Gordon or Logan Wormuth or Brandon Rogers or some of his other Orlando shortstops from a decade ago in high school. Did any of you guys ever force Boba Fett to play second base? I'm trying to think back to seeing him in the Under Armour game in 2015.
Let me interject.
Yeah.
Six games in the GCL in 2016.
So he has played some second base in the minors.
And one game in 2019 in Buffalo.
I don't remember asking him at the prospect pad in 2017, where I believe he came in first and Vladdy Jr. came in last. And I remember thinking, is there a rift here? What's going on with these guys? But Boba Fett also, just for me to Boba Fett, I miss that hair. I miss his old hair, 80 hair. But to me, he needs to move to second base. Place Isaiah Kiner-Falefa in the lineup and also use it as a platform. I think the motivation of being an impending free agent and playing in a World Series, you're trying to win and you're trying to, you know, assure other teams that you can make that transition. I think there's a lot of motivation for him to be his best at second base. That said, he's got a messed up knee. I mean, it was a PCL strain, if I'm not mistaken. He hasn't played for 6 weeks. I'm not worried about him hitting because he's a natural hitter. You can't hit with that level of movement in his swing that he's always had. It's always been a feature. The big hand pump, the big leg kick. He's always had a lot of movement in his swing, and yet he led the league in hits twice, and he would have led the league in hits again this year if he'd been healthy the whole season. So for me, Boba Fett, I'm not as worried about him hitting. I don't want to disrupt what's going right with George Springer at his age and with the, you know, hit by pitch off his knee that in the ALCS that clearly limited him a little bit, at least in his movements. Obviously didn't limit him in game seven, but for me, I want to disrupt George Springer as little as possible. If I'm going to disrupt anybody on the Blue Jays, it's going to be Isaiah Kiner-Falefa with that 40 grade arm. And let's see if Boba Fett can move just enough at second base to be properly positioned, knock the ball down, pick it up. You had an interesting idea about him playing third base that maybe you thought might be a better move for him. But I want him in the lineup. I don't want him on the bench.
Right. So the other option, obviously, here, you kind of obliquely talked about it, which is you could say, okay, can we get George Springer back into the outfield? Something he has not done in the postseason, but obviously he did play right field, played all three outfield positions during the regular season, but DH more games than he played in the field, period. You could do that. I was kind of initially leaning towards that, like, okay, that way you get Bobichet in the lineup, but you're with his knee coming up in the injury, you're not worried as much about that. Then I came away with it's like, you probably don't want to do that, because if you do that, you're then going to have that temptation in the later innings, if you're up, to pull Springer, and I don't want to pull Springer from games. Like, he's too important to the bat for them to say, hey, we've got a lead, it's the seventh, it's the eighth, it's even the ninth. We're going to now go to our defense lineup and Springer's out of the game. I don't think I'm have as much worry about doing that with going to a better defensive lineup in late innings with Bobichet than I do George Springer. The thing that I will give them credit for here, this all becomes multiple possibilities, because obviously they could. The other option is you play Bichet at short, position he's always played. You move Jimenez back to second. You put Ernie Clement at third. Now you can also, you have Addison Barger, who also kind of goes back and forth between the outfield and infield, who can also play third. You have, you could do that, make IKF your backup, your defensive replacement. You also can do that. So there are multiple options here, which is kind of a credit to the fact that you have guys like Clement and Jimenez who are going to give you really good defense kind of wherever you are.
That's really, to me, like one of the things that stands out about their roster the most. And I think Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins deserve a ton of credit. They have a lot of levers to pull for John Schneider. He's got a lot of different, you know, he can go door number one, door number two, door number three. So you can play him in as a shortstop. You could play Ernie Clement at shortstop. I wouldn't advise that, but he's sure-handed, and they have the difference for them this year, but several of their run prevention oriented players produced offensively at levels they hadn't produced in Toronto in 2024, when they were literally the last place team in the American League East. So Miles Straw is a defense oriented player, one of your all time faves, 2017 Buies Creek Astro JJ favorite, but he's a defensive oriented center fielder, defensive replacement, speed guy, and can really do that exceptionally well. Off the bench or in a platoon role against Blake Snell. Clement and Jimenez can move all around the infield, and they're plus defensive players at any of those positions. So it's a good option to have. They have options. They have levers to pull.
And they should not get to this point, but I always like to make the point that also I cannot think of another team in MLB history, basically, where you can carry two catchers on your postseason roster. But if something happened and like Kurt got hurt and Heinemann got hurt, and you're like, oh no, we're down to the emergency catchers. And you're looking at Dalton Varsho and IKF, and you're looking at both of them, and you're going, okay, which of you guys, both of whom have been quality MLB catchers at earlier parts of their career. That's like something that this is not the same thing as the third catcher where it's like, oh, you know, we've got Francisco Cabrera on the lineup because he can kind of catch, or, you know, but like something like that many, many years ago. They have two legitimate, used to be quality MLB catchers who are playing other positions very well defensively now. That's something that you just never see. That's going to be the fascinating part of this. And that leads into kind of this overarching question, which is, okay, the Dodgers are the favorite of this series. Let's just be clear. They are the dynasty, the potential dynasty. Because let's just be clear also. They win this World Series, and they are really the first dynasty since the Giants. As far as like, if you say that winning World, Astros, Giants, and Dodgers are the three teams I think you can say can make that argument since like the mid-2000s. You know, the Giants, obviously, the crazy part of this, the Giants won three World Series. Winning divisions, that wasn't really as much as their, part of their MO. But they did win three World Series in 6 years. So, but when you look at this Blue Jays team, how can the Blue Jays, what do you think has to happen? What do the Blue Jays have to do here to walk off with their first title in over 30 years?
Well, first off, I think the Dodgers have to not be as sharp as they were in the National League postseason. they were very sharp. They played one sloppy-ish game against the Phillies. I mean, that's the only one they lost. They didn't play great, I don't think, in game one against the Phillies. The Phillies jumped out to that lead. But when the Dodgers needed it, you know, they had offense. They had the big three-run homer by Teoscar Hernandez. They've had big hits up and down their lineup. I mean, their postseason offensive numbers are huge. When you're just looking up and down their lineup, I mean, Alex Call's like 3-for-7 or 4-for-7. Like Ben Rortvedt, speaking of backup catchers, has hit. So, you know, and they've had some adversity. You know, Will Smith didn't catch most of the month of September with a broken hand. I mean, this guy's been their best right-handed hitter this year. So that seemed like a potential problem. I don't think it's a problem anymore. So I think that you, number one, the Dodgers have to be not as sharp. And they are going to have, what, a one-week layoff, right, JJ?
Mm-hmm.
That's lengthy. I mean, that's not nothing. Even in the All-Star break, you don't go a full week without playing. So I think you have to hope the Dodgers aren't sharp if you're Toronto. Number two, Toronto has to be playing in its 90th percentile of outcomes. You've got to get George Springer getting big hits. He's the all-time winner and wins probability added in the postseason. I mean, all-time leader. You're going to need that level of George Springer. And, you know, what the Dodgers have shown the last two postseasons is their stars perform in the postseason, whether it's Freddie Freeman or Game 4 Shohei Ohtani. And they have the depth of stars that Shohei Ohtani can go 4-for-33 for a stretch of postseason games, and they can just go right along just fine without him. So Toronto doesn't have that level of depth. They're going to need Bichette. If he's going to play, Bichette has to be Bo Bichette. He has to be a pure hitter who can turn around velocity, who can hit this level of pitching. I really do think that's what the one thing that Blue Jays do have that other teams don't is guys like Kirk, Bichette, Guerrero. Do you question that those guys can hit good pitching? I don't. That's their whole MO, right? So
I don't think there's a pitcher born that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. can't hit.
Can't pull with authority and hit 113 mile an hour, like 3-iron, right? And, you know, like that goes over the left fielder's head. I mean, nobody hits pure line drives like that guy, except for maybe Ohtani and Giancarlo Stanton. From a pure line drive EV, that's your guy. But Bo Bichette is a pure hitter. He is in the small group of pure hitters for me in the major leagues. Alejandro Kirk, will never forget watching him look way too much like me on the backfields, watching him at Pirate City in a spring training game in 2019. That's a guy who one knee catching saved my life is what that's the song he should play on his when his career is over. But that guy can hit. He's short to the ball and long through the zone. I guess they call that good angles now, but he has good angles and is a pure hitter. I would also say Ernie Clement is that kind of hitter. It's a dead start, but it's not doesn't take him long. He's not trying to load up and crush every pitch. So he can hit velocity. So they have some hitters who are tuned that way. So I don't think you can expect Nathan Lucas and Jimenez hit two big home runs in the LCS. That's just not his game. So their stars are going to have to perform. But I think the matchup, they are a uniquely suited team in terms of pure hitting ability to hit the Dodgers pitching. So that's one. I think number two, really big one for Toronto is, again, Gausman, Scherzer, Yesavage. Their starting pitching is going to have to post, because I think the biggest difference is the Dodgers and the Blue Jays, neither one of these teams has a good bullpen, JJ. I mean, like, not a good bullpen, not to mention not a great bullpen. The Dodgers last year won with their bullpen being great in the postseason as well as their offense. Who do you think has the better bullpen here? I would give an edge to the field. So, I don't think either team has even what I would call a good bullpen at this stage.
I do think that that is kind of, I think that for the Blue Jays to win, they have to get into the Dodgers bullpen, because that is clearly the so much the Roki Sasaki's improvement in September or October has made a big difference, because it has reshifted everything, where all of a sudden he's the guy in those situations, not Blake Treinen, who was not handling them very well in September. That has really helped. Right. But there's still if you're the Dodgers, you are looking at this saying, we hope to get again through the sixth or seventh with our starter and hopefully hand it off to a pen with a couple of run, multiple run lead, where we say, hey, it's 3-1, it's 4-0, 4-0, it's 2-0, whatever it is, where it's like, there's a little bit of margin here. And if they don't, that's where I think the Blue Jays can do this. The other part you hit on, though, the Dodgers are very right-handed pitching-wise. This Blue Jays team's not particularly built to really exploit that, though. You know, really, right? Is it? I mean, it's not really. You don't look at this and say, "Oh, this is where, you know, this is where these lefties in the Blue Jays lineup can really feast on this." I mean, again, you hope that it's. If you're a Blue Jays fan, you hope that it's a good matchup for Dalton Varsho. You hope that it's a good matchup, you know, for, you know, Addison Barger, Jimenez. Like, you got guys like that, but it's not.
you don't have respect for my man Nathan Lucas, JJ. That's all there is to it.
I am not a – yes, I am. I know he has had a very good postseason. If that's so, that's the guy I want. If I'm the Dodgers, that's the guy I want up in situations where it's like we're going to let Nathan Lucas try to beat us. We're not going to let Vlad Jr. beat us. We're not going to let George Springer beat us. But again, when we talk about their big bats, are guys who are going to be facing platoon. The Dodgers are going to have the platoon advantage almost all of the time against basically the biggest of the Blue Jays.
I think that's a great point. I think that's an important point to mention. Sasaki is really the difference between the two bullpens. If I give an advantage to one, it would be to the Dodger bullpen because of Sasaki. Respect to Lewis Varlin, my former coworker. A tremendous development story. And he's been the one thing I will say for Lou Varlin. He is fearless. He has that velocity slap. I don't know if you've seen it. Used to focus on a lot in the Minnesota bullpen where they slap him on the back as hard as they can to get the adrenaline going. He gets up to a hundo. He's got that knuckle curve. That's a good out pitch right on right. I'm not sure he's got a great answer for left-handed hitters. If he's in a pocket, he's going to pitch. There's going to be an inning if the Blue Jays are winning a game where they're going to ask Lou Varlin to pitch like a seventh inning, and it's going to be like Ohtani, Betts, Freeman. And maybe Max.
And that's
Muncy.
The flip side here is that right. If you go right-handed against the Dodgers, if you go lefty against the Dodgers, it's like Mookie, you've got a little bit more of like it's a much more difficult challenge, especially like I said, that top of that lineup. You really want to have a right-handed, you know, do you want to have a right-handed pitcher on the mound when Shohei Ohtani steps to the plate?
No. And that's the problem. Are you gonna have Mason Fluharty? Are you gonna have Brendan Little? I'm like, Brendan Little has been, I think he led their team in appearances during the season. He's pitched a lot in the postseason, but mostly it's been in the next day or that night. It's been, oh, why did they use Brendan Little there? So to me, if there's an advantage.
Eric Lauer's not coming through that gate probably either. Is like, okay, this is the key moment we've been waiting for. But maybe it is.
Yeah, I'm not. So that's really, to me, that's it. Like the Dodgers bullpen isn't deep, but they do have two guys I trust in Sasaki and you just mentioned him. Oh, Alex Vesia.
No, I was going to say, I mentioned Blake Trinan, but I would not put him in the circle.
No, it's Alex Vesia. And I think he is in Dave Roberts' circle of trust. But like you said, there's not a ton of matchups that favor him, but they do favor Sasaki. So I think, you know, Roky Sasaki, who was, and that's the other fascinating part to me. These two franchises have been linked in the off seasons the last 2 years by the Ohtani chase and the Sasaki chase. And in both cases, Toronto thought they were really in on it. Was it Sasaki where they traded for Miles Straw and his $13 million in 2 years? Just they acquired him as well as some international bonus pool money, right?
And the trade was Miles Straw and international bonus pool money for a player to be named or cash considerations. And I have found no record of any player to be named or cash considerations that later went back in return, because it was pretty much like if you'll take the player's contract, we'll give you the bonus pool money and we'll throw in some money, I believe, also to help pay for some of the contract. It was it was a trade of like, we give you this. What do we get back in return? We're good.
That's right. Now, I also go back further that when Alex Anthopoulos had the apple of his eye was Vlad Guerrero Jr. after he saw him when he was 14 years old, they traded two future major leaguers, two prospects to the Dodgers for the pool money so they could max out on Vlad Guerrero Jr. signing him in 2015. I believe it was John Birdie and Chase DeJong. Do I remember that right?
By the way, well done. Well done.
Okay, good. I mean, I wrote that.
I'm saying well done on Vlad, like acquiring Vlad Jr., two big leaguers. Well done.
Two thumbs up, yes. And John Birdie, I think, was still active this past season at age 36.
That's the perfect way, I think, for us to wrap this up, which is we haven't talked enough. Like, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and we did this a little bit on the CrossFit podcast this week, too, but I want to do it here again. Like, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. We could do an appreciation of Shohei Ohtani. He's incredible. He's that, but Vlad Jr. is more of incredible in the realm of things that are easier to understand, right? This is a guy who's been the best hitter on every field he's ever stepped onto since he was probably 13 or 14, right? Like, this is something where, and here he is, to his credit, like, he is a very good first baseman, which is really all you were hoping for there. But
I agree.
And that's a perfect way to end it here, which is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. We talk a little bit more about him. He has been the best hitter on probably every field he stepped on since he was like 14 years old. He fits within the realm of, like, Shohei Ohtani is in the I can't explain it because there's no one else like him. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is the I can't explain it. He's just an incredible hitter. He hits the ball incredibly hard. Hit stinging line drive after stinging line drive. He's become a very solid first baseman defensively, I feel like, as well. He is also embraced, I would say, the role of team leader. Like, he is now, when you talk about the face of the franchise part of that, he's got the long-term, the long-term contract. Toronto has embraced him. He has embraced Toronto. He understands the magnitude of this moment. We have that play of him going to third and then scampering home, which is not something that you would say, like, that you would expect the heady, speedy base running Vladimir Guerrero Jr. play. But what stands out to you about Vlad Jr., having basically watched him? Again, we've been fortunate. This is a guy that we were talking about in top 100 meetings and putting him in the top 100, I believe, before he maybe ever played an actual official professional game.
That sounds about right. And I was lucky to see him and Bichette play in spring training games all the time in my scouting gig. What I think about with Vlad Jr. is just that he's like the perfect distillation of his dad and modern baseball. If you talk to people who didn't get a chance to see Vlad Sr.'s whole career, all they think of is him swinging at the ball that bounced the plate. And yes, he was a free swinger, but he was a 70 hitter because he had such barrel feel and he had tremendous power as well, which was muted somewhat by his inability to control the strike zone and hit the fact that he chased a lot. We didn't have chase rates per se, like we measure them now. We didn't have the same data, but he was noted for his aggression. And you have his son who has a similar power, similar ability to barrel a ball and an ability to barrel the ball no matter where it's pitched, but who has evolved from his old man to be selective, to know the strike zone. What was the stat that you gave in the podcast the other day that he had like 14 home runs and 27 strikeouts in Double A? That's extreme. So that's just a level of, I mean, when I think of it as a old man baseball fan now, I think of DiMaggio, who I never saw, not that old. But like he had 369 career strikeouts and 361 career home runs, if memory serves. And it usually does. This guy's, in a modern context, one of the higher contact, high power guys. So to me, he's just like his dad, but more evolved. Clearly not as athletic, but I think he's actually undersold for his defensive first base. Over 162 games, one of the ways you pace yourself is, I'm not diving for that ball. I'm not going all out for that ball. But in the postseason, I think we've seen it. And to me, one of the defining characteristics of baseball in 2025 is teams that try to go cheap at first base and teams that spend at first base is another separator. These two teams spend at first base. They're getting what they pay for. They have great players at first base. I guess technically they both could play first base for Canada and the World Baseball Classic next year. I'm just trying to give you the fever a little bit, JJ, just un poquito of the fever. The fever still runs deep for me. But both these guys are two-way players at first base, and they're both hit over power with tremendous power. So that's a great matchup. But I think Vlad Jr. to me, he's just a more highly evolved, more modern version of his old man. and his old man's a Hall of Famer. So that's a great player. And just watching his career progress and some of the ups and downs, I think he answered a lot of critics this year. I think the regular seasons for Vlad Jr. have been very good, with one truly great season, and that was 2021, where they didn't play every game at home, right? In Canada, they played them all before, elsewhere.
Though, like, you hit 323, 396, 544. That's
great.
That's great.
That's what got him that $500 million contract. And I think you have to look at the Blue Jays, and to wrap it up, to me, the Blue Jays committing to him and him committing to Toronto, from a vibe standpoint, they had gone to the playoffs in 2023 and been swept out again. They were 0-6 in three playoff trips with this core. And then they go to last place in 2024. They miss out on Ohtani. You know, they get psyched by the wrong tweets and the wrong airplane and all that stuff. They have a bad 2024. They don't land Sasaki. The vibes had to change. And I think the number one thing that changed their vibes was him committing to the Blue Jays and the Blue Jays committing to him. You can't quantify vibes. I think they are real. I think that their vibes changed as a franchise. And then the players took advantage of that, and the front office did too. And we didn't even mention Shane Bieber in the two rotations part. That was the key trade. This was not a great trade for rotation pieces at the deadline. The Blue Jays, you know, got in very much at the end and got Lou Varland, like everyone else was getting bullpen pieces. But Shane Bieber was the best starting pitcher traded at the deadline. He was definitely a two rotations guy, and he's going to start. And they've got a rookie, a true number one in my mind, and Gausman, and two former Cy Young Award winners in Bieber and Scherzer. That is a blueprint for a World Series championship rotation. The problem is the Dodgers also have that kind of rotation. So I do think it sets up to be a good World Series. I do favor the Dodgers, but I do think they're a pass for the Blue Jays.
No, I think, yeah, like they do have it. By the way, there's one other Vlad Jr. stat I wanted to share, which is that since 2021, his low in games played is 156. The other thing to say about Vlad Jr. is he is there day in, day out, over and over. He really hasn't had kind of a significant missed time at any point in his career, which also outstanding.
If I had a bugle, I'd play it, because he goes to post. And that is what the money is for.
So I know that if you all listen to this, if you're at the 55-minute mark of this, you also are excited about the World Series. We're very excited. We cannot wait to see what's going to happen. This is what, you know, again, the way that we always try to put it, the way that I always talk about it with the BA staff is like, I learned this from you. This is what you're looking for, because not that you want to go overboard, right? It doesn't mean that that when you see this rotation, that this Dodgers rotation is what every team should have or can have or anything like that. But you are watching every aspect we cover, from high school, you know, 15-year-olds to the big leagues. It's all aimed towards this. You are trying to use this as your calibration tool, because when you see what these players do, this is the standard. This is the standard that is at least the aspirational standard for all players on their way. When we talk about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Freddie Freeman or Shohei Ohtani's not even aspirational. Don't even try to aspire to that, anybody. You can't do it. But these other players you are talking about, that is what you are aspiring to. How does this player compare to the top players in the major leagues? And these are, we have a lot of the top players in major league. George Springer, we didn't talk about him a ton, but it's great to see the guy who we were talking about when he was at UConn. I remember the agony of trying to figure him out in the minor leagues. And I think we had this great write-up up at baseballamerica.com again about how if he just makes enough contact, you are talking about a regular all-star, and to his credit, he did.
He came along, and I mean, he's had an amazing career, a historic career from what he's done in the postseason, and he's trying to get a third ring, correct? Or is on his second ring? He wasn't on 2022 Houston, but he's trying to get a ring that doesn't come with an asterisk for a lot of fans. And there's a legacy piece for George Springer as well. I mean, if he's the key cog on this team, where he's fourth in the major leagues in OPS and leads the Toronto Blue Jays back to the promised land, I think it's a Hall of Fame piece for him. So there's a lot on the line for these teams. But like you said, this is ultimately, when we talk about profile, this is where those profiles are created, championship profiles. So it's going to be fun to watch, and happy to talk about it with you for the last however long this podcast winds up being timed at.
But so for John, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.